Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC. So this Friday, November 21st, is the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. Among the celebrants is the writer Gay Talese, who has a parallel 50th of his own for his book, The Bridge, The Building of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. The book is dedicated to, quote, the iron workers. And as Gay says in a new preface to the book, it's less a celebration of the bridge itself, or the renowned politicians and architects who were in the news for it back then, like Othmar Ammann or Robert Moses, whose stories are amply told here, but more a celebration, quote, of the high-stepping men who built it, the very men who, incidentally, were not invited to attend the opening day ceremony 50 years ago, unquote. Gay Talese, the dapper dressing East Sider, was one of the originators of literary journalism in the 1960s and 70s at Esquire, The Times, New York Magazine, and in his 11 books. I've seen him quoted saying he would rather have a story on page 35 of a newspaper than on page 1, because the people whose stories are only deemed worthy of page 35 are more interesting. So Gay Talese, thank you for coming on and welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
Did you say that thing about page 35 versus page 1?
Well, I probably did, and probably what I meant was that at least the New York Times, which is the only paper I've ever worked for, the emphasis on the news, which is what was on page 1, was rather devoid of much personality. It was more fact-driven. News, by its very nature, is the work of people of position or power. And the larger New York, when I was a city reporter for those almost 10 years, I wished to write about people out of power, people who were in the shadows of the city, of this towering city, all these skyscrapers and bridges you mentioned. And I felt that their stories were also worthy of being told. And I did devote myself to finding those people and writing their stories.
Do you think, by the way, since you put it that way, that page 1 of the New York Times has changed in that respect since you were there?
I think it has. The current administration at the New York Times does have more occasionally an inclination to put human interest stories on the front page. There's usually one. Sometimes it's at the bottom, but it's there. In my day, which is the post-World War II period, I joined the Times in 1954. I left in 1965. But in my day, it was more of a strictly hard newspaper. It is still a paper that covers the news in a serious way, but it integrates within its body of work human interest stories, as I mentioned before. And some of them that get on the front page are surprised they're there.
And when you say human interest, you don't mean puff pieces. You mean stories that explore issues through the stories of regular, quote-unquote, individuals.
That's right.
And so you write in the new preface to the book that when you first moved to New York in the mid-50s, you often asked yourself, whose fingerprints are on the bolts and beams of these soaring edifices that in this overreaching city? Nice adjective for New York, by the way, overreaching. What was it that made you curious about the construction workers?
Well, when I first arrived as a young man coming from the provinces of South Jersey, I was astonished by the height of the buildings. I'd never been in New York before. And I wondered, in the case of the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building or the Brooklyn Bridge, who actually did the work? I knew from my limited reading of the history of New York that the Roebling brothers were the father and son designers of the Brooklyn Bridge, for example. But I had no idea who were the laborers or who were the engineers or the superintendents of contractors, etc. So when I did get a job in the Times, in one of my assignments in 1959, the editor sent me out to Brooklyn, to Bay Ridge section of Brooklyn, people were protesting. It was almost the aura of Occupy Wall Street mentality of those people who were so angry at Robert Moses. You mentioned his name before.
Because of all the stuff that would be torn down.
Yes. Whenever a major contract goes for a big building or a bridge, many people have to move because the approachways, in this case, to the Verrazano Bridge, Verrazano Narrows Bridge, would take hundreds and hundreds of homes in the Bay Ridge section that leading to the approachway to the Brooklyn side of the bridge. And people had no choice. You had to move. You had to lose your home. You had to lose your connections with your neighborhood. You had a business. You had to lose your business location. And it was not done with great deal of understanding. It was intolerant, seemed, of Robert Moses to expect people to give up their whole lives. Well, nevertheless, that's what they had to do. The bridge took priority over their personal lives. And he went ahead and built so many things. I mean, the great Robert Caro, he's probably been on your show before, mm-hmm. wrote this great book called The Power Broker. It's about this very man we're talking about now, who built, among other things, the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. I happen to go from the protest to wonder, who are the people that are going to build the bridge? And that's when I, beginning in 1960 and going on the next 4 years through 1964, I watched step by step as these various kinds of specialists in ironwork, steel workers, men who climbed to high altitudes, as you referred to before, went about the process of building this 2.5 mile long structure that linked a section of Brooklyn to a section of Staten Island, and this horizontal rainbow roadway was linking people who had formerly had to use ferries to get back and forth. And this was a big thing and wonderful watching it. And I got to know numbers and numbers of people individually who are workers.
Obviously a big, big deal for the people of Staten Island, revolutionary change for the people of Staten Island. I wonder, since you brought up Moses again and Caro, if you think, because I think Caro's Moses has become the Robert Moses of the public imagination to the extent that anybody ever thinks about Robert Moses. Robert Moses, the arrogant destroyer, rather than Robert Moses, the builder, as certainly he saw himself with all the stuff that he spearheaded in terms of New York infrastructure. Do you think Robert Caro, do you think Robert Moses has a bum rap in his legacy today?
Well, he certainly is not looked upon as a benign figure. A benevolent despot might be the term, drawn from some Renaissance kings I used to read about. Whether he is as bad as Mr. Caro depicts him is not for me to say. What is the truth that I saw was the arbitrariness of Moses toward those who had to move. But on the other hand, a bridge had to be built, so he believed. Whereas the people in Brooklyn, the protesting people at that time in 1959, used to carry signs that said, "The bridge, who needs it?" And many people, not only in Brooklyn but Staten Island, didn't want their way of life to change. I mean, it was virtual. Staten Island was virtual farmland in the late 1950s. And they didn't want the intrusion of city life, urban life, automobiles, pollution, etc. And all of this was in the offing as the bridge would link the Staten Island people to the larger ills of urban life, New York style.
Gay Talese, the 50th anniversary of his book, The Bridge, The Building of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, as this Friday is the 50th anniversary of the opening of the bridge. And listeners, this book is told in photographs as well as words. Photos of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge under construction and the men who are constructing it. So we invite you to follow along on our website as we refer to a couple of these images at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And listeners, I wonder if anyone who worked on the Verrazano Bridge happens to be listening, including people Gay Talese wrote about in the book, or even if he didn't write about you. I don't know if any of you are listening, but maybe we'll get lucky. We invite you to add your voice and story on the air with us, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Maybe someone whose story is told here in print wants to do a little oral history, too, 212-433-9692, if you're out there. By the way, I can't help but notice that you say it Verrazano, and I'm just saying Verrazano, like the zzz, and you're saying tss. like it's a TS almost. Now, is this – you're of Italian heritage, right?
Yes.
Is this the proper Italian?
I think Verrazzano is – I don't really wish to be so specific. I don't know that that is a warrants correction or not. The Verrazzano Narrows Bridge, that's what I believe.
Did people say it a lot that way back then? Because I don't think anybody says it that way.
You
now.
Don't. I guess it shows my age. Don't forget, I went up with the bridge, and now the bridge is as young as it always was, and I've gotten considerably older. And some of these men that I knew, you make reference to the people who built the bridge, many of them, dozens of them, are still alive. They're close to their my age, 80, 81, 79. I have kept in touch with many of them. And some of them might well be listening to your show right now.
Well, we'll see. They're all over. And we'll see if anyone calls in. And here's how all over they are. Chapter one of your book is called The Boomers, not for the baby boomers, who officially stopped being born the same year, 1964, but for the workers who would follow construction booms from town to town. Tell us the story of a boomer.
Well, word would go out across the country of a big project that's going to be built. Now, New York has, in Manhattan, there's a union of iron workers. It's called Local 40. Brooklyn has also a union, and other Westchester County, different unions. And across the country, there are unions. And when there are so many jobs, because a big project brings many jobs, there's so many jobs that the union will allow out-of-towners, some far away from California or Canada, Indian reservation in Canada. Many Indians are in the ironworking business, as you probably know from previous readings. They come down. And at one time, I saw, I think it was around 1962 or 3 when I was watching, there were about 500 people working on the bridge on a single afternoon. So the union in New York was only a part representation of the workforce. And these characters from all over the – sometimes other places outside the United States who had worked on big projects. For example, when I first went up to the Verrazzano in 1962, I met old-timers who'd worked on the George Washington Bridge in the 1930s. Mm. Or many of the people who were working – that I came to know on the Verrazzano project were the sons and grandsons of workers going back almost 100 years. Most of the men are the sons and grandsons, and they have children and grandchildren. I know one man in New York. He's still alive, and he's not only alive, he's very active. His name is Robert Walsh. He's 70 years old, and he is the business leader of the Iron Workers Union, Local 40, with an office on 31st and Park Avenue South.
And he's got a grown son in the business?
Robert Walsh, yes. His father was an iron worker. He's an iron worker. He was an apprentice at the age of 19 on the Verrazzano Bridge in 1962. And he has two sons and grandsons as well who are iron workers. And this is not atypical.
It's a little atypical in America, though, isn't it? Because isn't the dream usually, okay, I had to build bridges for a living with my own two hands. I want you to go to college and not have to do that.
Well, I know a young man who went to college for 1 year. His name is Joe Spratt, S-P-R-A-T-T. I knew his grandfather, Eugene Spratt. He was a worker on the Verrazzano Bridge in 1962. And this grandson, Joe Spratt, went to college for 1 year, and he finally said, I had to leave because I wanted to do iron work more. He says, as a kid, that's all I heard. His father and his grandfather were both, as the case with Walsh and many, many people. He says, that's all I heard. The men would carry the lore, the mystique of the job. This job brought great pride. They were doing something that lasted a lifetime, and a great project does. And they talked about it at home, and their kids would – it's almost like ball players. I mean, there's so many ball players, you know, who have sons who become major league ball players, who had grandfathers that were major league ball players. It's something like in the circus. There's that tradition sometimes within families to continue the family trade.
I think I got a couple of you boys on the line. Jim in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, Brian. Hi, Gay. I'm an iron worker at Local 40.
Jim who?
Jim Connor.
Jim Connor.
You know
and,
him?
There are a lot of Connors in this business.
Bob Walsh is a great guy.
Oh, yes. We know that.
And I worked on the rehab of the wind bracing and the outer cantilevers on the bridge. You know, just replacing a lot of, you know, flooding neglected repairs that have been, you know, put off for a long time. Anyway, it's a great fraternity, and I love your analogy of the ironworkers to baseball players.
But they are athletic. You have to be rather, not only strong, you have to be strong because so much of that steel is actually handled by hand.
Exactly.
You know? And also you have to be fairly fearless because no one does that kind of work if you're timid.
Jim, thank you.
It was one time I went to Bobby Walsh when I was new in the trade, and he asked me, how do you get around? And I told him, I can get pretty much anywhere on the subway or the bus. And he dropped this newspaper. He was reading a sporting page. And he said, on the iron. I'm not talking about trains and buses. How do you get around on the iron? So, you know, I felt like crawling into a corner.
He was worried about whether you're a reckless person. In fact, Bobby Walsh had actually fell two times as a worker on the Verrazzano Bridge,
and
both times
part
in the nets.
Part of what you document in the book is people, this is a profession in which people die.
That's right. The George Washington Bridge, 7 died. Down the Verrazzano Bridge, only 3 died. But after the third death,
only
the union, 40, Local 40, insisted on nets, and twice this Robert Walsh, who is still alive and active as the manager of the union, he fell, and of course he lives to tell about it. But many who were unlucky are not with us as chroniclers of the bridge.
Jim, and thank you for your call. We're almost out of time, but I want to play a one-minute soundbite from the WNYC archives. This is Mayor Robert Wagner dedicating the Verrazzano Narrows Bridge 50 years ago this week.
We look out today upon a stretch of water across which the old world came to build the new. This was the channel of approach to the shores of the Golden Land, the land of promise, opportunity, and freedom, the city of a million dreams. And a million people came, and then another million, and then more millions, sailing, steaming, and then flying over this route. And now we have built a land bridge over these narrows, linking mainland and island in a breathtaking feat of imagination and construction. A beautiful bridge is the architect's crown, the builder's triumph, an unquestioned public asset. And our city is linked by bridges and held together by bridges. This latest addition to our city's great wealth of bridges represents a new summit of achievement. Surely we must see it not only as the biggest, but as the most beautiful of all, the most princely, and the most stately.
Mayor Robert Wagner.
Robert Ferdinand Wagner.
I didn't know that. November 21st, 1964. Do you agree with him, before you go, that this, of all the bridges, is the best of the best, the most of the most? He says the most beautiful of all, the most princely, the most stately at the end of that
clip. Well, I think there's probably one person, were he alive, I think there's no doubt he would say this. That's not true. He would say the man who designed the Verrazzano Bridge is the same man who some 30 years before, Mr. O.H. Ammon, designed the George Washington. And he sort of believed these were twin beauties, not one more than the other. So we have in this city, at least, and over in the Hudson, both cases, two great, beautiful bridges, both.
And there we leave it with Gay Talese on this 50th anniversary week of the opening of the Verrazzano Bridge, or the Verrazzano Bridge, if you prefer. Gay Talese's book, which came out pretty much simultaneously and is out now in a new edition for the 50th anniversary, is called The Bridge, The Building of the Verrazzano Narrows Bridge. Gay Talese, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.
I appreciate that, too.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011 for successfully mobilizing Muslim and Christian women in her home country of Liberia. Her tactics were unprecedented in the country. She led the women in a peaceful protest that effectively helped to end Liberia's 14-year-long civil war. Now, Lema Bowie is worried that Ebola in Liberia will undo some of her work toward women's equality that was integral to her anti-war movement. Lema Bowie, an honor once again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you so much.
I see that you recently wrote a piece in The Guardian about the threat of Ebola in Liberia and how the spread of the virus is threatening to undo the progress made after the war. Can you explain the connection between the two?
Well, Ebola has become a disease that has exposed the inability of our government and those in power to deal with the issues that actually led to the war: inequalities, the widening gaps between the rich and the poor, and also dealing with issues of reconciliation. Once the virus hit, they had restrictions on different communities. This led to some uprising, but in some of the communities, the ones that have never made the mainstream media prior to the end of the war, they had situations of Christian and Muslim tensions. In some of these communities today, the Muslims are objecting to the fact that they cannot do their burial the way they used to, because they are the ones who have really suffered the virus in most communities.
And that's one of the main ways, I understand, that the virus is spreading. It's unsafe burial practices that allow the virus to spread from corpse to living people.
Yeah. And so in some of these communities, they're putting restrictions on their burial practices, whilst the Christians who have not died from Ebola, people who have not died, go to funeral home and they're having funeral services. So in some communities, you're seeing objections from some of these people saying, we are now going to stop, you know, like a few months back, we'll stop Christians from doing burial or we'll disrupt. And those tensions begin to come up, and communities now have to remobilize to begin the whole conversation about coexistence and all of the different things. So the virus has just really, really challenged the fabric of the peace in Liberia. You have upset communities. We never had healthcare system. Our people are dying. Where you find communities of middle-income people, no one is getting infected. But beyond just the virus, the inability of poor people, pregnant women to access hospitals because they don't have those kind of resources. There was a story that one young woman gave birth to a set of twins on the sidewalk because she could not afford to pay the $300 the hospital was charging to give birth and to help her give birth.
Terrible.
So you have all of these tensions coming up.
And you've often said, I know, that it's women who bear the biggest burdens during conflict situations. Are you finding that same adage to be true as Liberia struggles to contain and fight Ebola?
Definitely, because you see, Ebola is a disease that is spread through contact. And most times you find women not able to deal with the fact that a relative is sick and they cannot engage or touch that relative. They are the main caregivers in the home. So they are the ones who are out there really getting it, because they have to cater to children, they have to cater to husbands, they have to cater to this thing. But one of the other beauty of all of this is that it's the same women's groups that mobilized during the war that are now mobilizing to provide awareness and sensitization in their local vernacular on the virus. And this has been really successful. They are also developing ingenious, I would say, ways of dealing with handling people where they don't have PPE, that's the personal protection equipment. They're using plastic bags and showing community people how to use these plastic bags to handle sick patients. So it's up to them. Keep the community safe. It's up to them. Provide the awareness. It's also up to them to maintain the peace when tensions arise in the communities.
What about those tensions between Christians and Muslims, as you were explaining them before, over burial practices? Does the Christian community need to learn to not fear Muslim burial practices, even if they're threatening in terms of Ebola spread to the Muslims involved? Or what do you think the solution is
there? I think the solution is a lot of awareness and sensitization. First thing first, let's take a step back. When the virus started in Liberia, lack of trust in the government really led to the spread of the virus. In March, when they started talking about the virus, people were like, oh, this is the government way of getting more money from the international community misapply. So when all of these sensitization issues were coming up, some communities were just resistant. We don't want to hear it. It's a lie. Those communities, I remember the churches in July had a whole thing where every Sunday, the pastors had to give like 5 minutes of Ebola awareness to their congregation. Did that happen in the mosques? I don't think so. And so you had a community that was prepared to deal with it, and then you had a community where people had not really gone in to do the kind of sensitization. So once the virus hit, I think communities decided now that it doesn't matter which religious group you're from, it's about life and the life of humans, so they begin to work with each other. Dialogue is the way. Awareness is the way. Education and sensitization is the way. And these are the things that community people are doing in Liberia.
The Nobel Peace Prize winner, Lema Bowie from Nigeria.
Liberia.
What did I say? Nigeria? I conflated two countries. From Liberia, not Nigeria or Nigeria. 212-433-WNYC, maybe for some of our Liberian listeners or others from the region. And I think we have Ibrahim from Sierra Leone originally calling in. Ibrahim, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Brian. Once again, thanks for your show. And I'm glad she got to the bottom of the problem. Now, the fundamental problem is lack of trust in the government. It could be Ebola, it could be measles, it could be whatever. Brian, these guys are so corrupt, these politicians. Now, imagine Liberia. Ask that lady how many hospitals they have in Liberia and how many counties they have in Liberia. There is no basic infrastructure. Yeah. Regardless of whatever aid the international community sends, if the infrastructure is not there to make that aid go into the best effect, it's still going to be a problem. Now, I just want to list a few things, Brian, if you can allow me, you know.
And I'm actually going to ask you to keep it to one because our time is short and I want to give some people an opportunity. Name one.
The one thing that I will pin it to is corruption. All these politicians in Liberia, Sierra Leone, in Guinea, all of them have foreign accounts. They own properties in the outside world. They bring their children to America, England, France.
And I can tell you, Ibrahim, that Lema Bowie is nodding vigorously as you say that. Ms. Bowie?
Well, he's not telling lies. Over the last few years, we've been critical of governments on the continent about their failure to provide the basic infrastructure for the people. The Ebola just came and exposed them because, especially for my own country, Liberia has a celebrated leader. And so coming outside or even staying in the country and coming outside and saying to the world, this is how people feel about how things are being done. You become first an enemy to the state. You become enemy to the people who are outside and have so much confidence, especially this government, in the government. And all of a sudden, there's a virus. And all of a sudden, the international community wakes up one morning and is like, oh, my God. Everything everyone has been saying, because there are no infrastructure, the lack of confidence in the government's ability to do things. I mean, from March till July, if there was care for people, if there was the infrastructure to address these problems, we would not have a pandemic that would be spreading to New York that would have you looking like a virus when you speak, you know?
The ongoing corruption, the ongoing lack of infrastructure investment, suddenly of interest to the outside world because they're interested in Ebola. Ollie in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, Lema. Good morning, Brian.
Hi there.
Good morning.
Yeah. I just want to ask because these days we have been hearing that Ebola is on a decline in Liberia. Like before, it was in all the 15 counties. But now only 5 counties carry the virus. So how true is that?
Ali, thank you very much. Our caller originally from Liberia, I know. And I've read the same thing, that Ebola is actually now on the decline in Liberia in particular. Can you confirm that?
Yes. One of the ways that my mother used to say to me, because my mother has lived through the Ebola virus, or she's still there, and she would say to me, every morning her trauma was the siren. You know, the sound of the siren. She lived in a community that was one of the hotspots.
The siren, like the
yes,
ambulance siren.
Yes, the ambulance coming in and taking dead people, a whole household wiped out. And she said the way the communities were able to track that the virus was coming down was the limited sound of sirens in their communities. Of course, it's coming down. One thing you need to understand from studies and what we've read on the internet is that the dry season contributes to the decline.
Uh-huh.
The question is, do we now relax and say now that we have 6 months of dry season? Because remember when the Ebola virus started in March, it was the dry season. So we didn't see an increase from March, April, May until June and July when the rain really hit. So what do we do now? Like the first caller from Sierra Leone said, investing in infrastructure, investing in awareness, really begin to tackle it. Don't look at just Liberia decline and say we will relax. Because as long as Sierra Leone is still a problem, Guinea is still a problem with our porous borders, next rainy season, we could see an implosion of the virus again.
Let me ask you about a couple of other things before you go. This year's Nobel Peace Prize went to two people, as you know, including the already legendary young woman, Malala Yousafzai from Pakistan, also on girls and women's rights. Do you have any thoughts on Malala? Have you met her?
No, I haven't met Malala. My schedule is crazy. Hers is crazy. And I know that people from both of our teams have been trying to put us together. And eventually, I know when we meet, I'm going to have the mother hen attitude towards her, like I do with Tawaku every time we find ourselves in a space. But for me, Malala's win is just a testament of the many Malalas that we have in countries around the world. When I traveled to DR Congo, to South Sudan, to Ethiopia, to Liberia, to Sierra Leone, in the different communities, you have young girls who are Malalas every day. What does this indicate for me as a peace activist, and I would say like an older person? For me, it is testament that our world in the future will have good leaders who will lead us to the path of peace that we're actually working for. But Brian, just before I go, I just want to also make this very clear. You know, we see a lot of reports on the internet about the international community's assistance to Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone as it relates to Ebola, and we're really grateful. But what you don't read about is the everyday local heroes. In Liberia, you have doctors like a Dr. Brown, who kept a local hospital open and have treated people. A few weeks ago, our foundation went and made donations. We got there when there was just water. You have women in communities who have been out there doing things. And these things would not have been possible without our donors, like the Segal Family Foundation, the American Jewish World Service, and people who still, Abigail Disney, Daphne Foundation, people who still have interest in the ability of local people to tackle their national problems. So I just have to say this. So all of the fight on Ebola has not just been the international community. There were local people. First, there are local people now working in partnership with this international community. And I thought to say a big thank you to all of our partners, those who have funded the Bowie Peace Foundation to do the Ebola awareness. It's been a wonderful time, and thank you for having me on your show.
And thank you so much for coming. I appreciate the shout-out to all those people who you thanked, and I get the point about thanking the people in the local community. And Lema Bowie, Nobel Peace Prize winner in 2011, and also founder of and executive director of Women, Peace, and Security Network Africa. Good luck with your ongoing work.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC, and Anne Lamott is with us now. Her stories and essays, her wit and insights have helped so many people through tough times and inspired us to good times. Maybe you've read Stitches or Help, Thanks, Wow or Grace Eventually. Anne Lamott's new book is called Small Victories, Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace in Our Everyday Lives. Anne, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thank you.
I thought we might focus mostly on your essay called Forgiven. You call forgiveness the hardest work we do. Can forgiveness really be harder than loss or decline or addiction?
Well, you don't have any choice, really, with loss or decline. And with the addiction, it's kind of controversial whether you do or not. But, oh, yeah, you know, for me, as a woman on a spiritual path, the two things you're supposed to be into are letting go and letting God and forgiveness. And those are my two weakest points. You know, if somebody says to me, let go, I'm like, God, I just want to smack them, you know. Obviously, if I could let go, I would be letting go. And then with forgiveness, oh, people say forgive and forget. And it just brings out the monster in me, because if I could forgive, I would. But also, I think forgiveness is the most important work we do. I think this earth here is kind of forgiveness school. I was 60 in April, and I thought I would be a lot better by now. And a lot of the books of Small Victories, a lot of the pieces tend to be about forgiveness, because it really is the single hugest miracle you can experience for your heart to be cold and clenched and all of a sudden to feel warmly towards someone who's hurt you.
And your first line in that chapter, Forgiven, is, I went around saying for a long time that I am not one of those Christians who are heavily into forgiveness, that I am one of the other kind. Ha. So how much are you being cute there? Since
I'm reform.
Christianity and Jesus have forgiveness pretty close to their core.
Yeah, I know. But I think a lot of people are faking it. And if you tell me that the far right-wing Christians of the Tea Party are heavily into forgiveness, I would laugh till I wept. And it's very hard work, because what it means is probably if you've been the one injured who needs to forgive, you need to re-experience the wound and how awful you felt and the shame someone caused you or the desolation and the rejection. And of course, in America, we're just taught to march ever onward and to stay one step ahead of the abyss and to not feel these really awful feelings. And in fact, maybe just go to IKEA and trick them out with a cute area rug. But the real work for me of healing and restoration involves horribly forgiving everyone. And when somebody that I have injured forgives me, I could die. I'm so grateful and so touched, because I know that they had to re-experience whatever harshness I brought onto them.
I heard you sneak the politics in there with your Tea Party reference, and I was going to read a few lines down in that chapter where you wrote, I tried to will myself into forgiving various people who had harmed me directly or indirectly over the years, 4 former Republican presidents, 3 relatives, 2 old boyfriends, and 1 teacher in a pear tree. It was the 12 days of Christmas meets Taxi Driver. Ha. So interesting that you threw the 4 Republican presidents in there along with the old boyfriends.
Well, I believe that the end of the world in America that has led us to where we are now began with St. Ronald Reagan. And it took me a long, you know, he was our governor. I'm from California. And he famously said, seen one redwood, seen them all. And he destroyed what was the greatest public education system in the country. And he threw all the people, many, many, many people with very severe mental illness onto the streets because of, you know, trickle-down economics and rising boats or whatever. And anyway, don't get me started. And then we had George Herbert Walker Bush, who I think, looking back, was not quite as destructive as say, then his son, and who is, out on a book tour side by side with me. So it's all sort of interesting. And I'm really crushed and devastated by what this country does to its poor and does to its elderly and does to its children. And I'm an activist. So what can I say? Yeah. I'm a little tense on the subject.
You know, I recently did for the show an analysis of all the ideological political books that made it to number one on the Times nonfiction bestseller list in the last 25 years. And there were 38 conservative books by, you know, Bill O'Reilly and people like that. And just 17 liberal books. So conservatives read. And I was going to ask you, does it hurt your book sales to be unabashedly anti-Republican when you're otherwise a Christian self-help author?
I'm not a self-help author. Yeah.
How would you call it?
Go ahead. I would say that I'm a person writing essays about what happens when we very, very human and vulnerable people step on the cosmic banana peel and go down and really need a lot of help getting back up. But anyway, I take your point, and I can't tell. I know fundamentalist Christian bookstores don't carry my work. I realized that with Traveling Mercies, which was probably 15 or more years ago. And when I was out on tour for that, and in the South, people would call in and they'd say, "Well, Miss Lamott, I just wonder how witty you think you're going to be when you're rotten in hell for all eternity." So I will say, well, thank you for sharing, and you get to think what you think. But I don't actually think it hurts my sales. And people come up to me wherever I am, and they say, "Oh, I know you don't have a lot of us conservatives," but you know, I have two friends, passionately close friends, who are conservatives, and we just don't talk about it, you know.
And I saw your tweet.
You don't talk about God or politics, yeah.
Other than that, you talk about everything. I saw your tweet this morning that said, "I don't care if people don't buy small victories, if they don't like my positions on immigration or women's rights." So
that's right.
You put it out there.
The grave, I'm going to be marching for women's rights. And it's just the way I came. And I came by this honestly. My parents were left-wing activists too. But of course, they were atheists. So I guess it skipped a generation.
So listeners, who's an Anne Lamott reader out there who wants to talk to her or ask her a question? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Her new book of essays is called Small Victories, Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace. And Dave in Greenwich, you're on WNYC with Anne Lamott. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much. And Anne, I just want to say I have valued all of your work. Bird by Bird was a massive move forward for me in writing. And as you were talking about forgiveness, it occurs to me that forgiveness is the greatest gift that we can give to ourselves, because it separates us from all that poison, like drinking the poison and hoping the other person dies.
Yeah.
It is truly a freeing force.
Drinking the rat poison. Yeah, it's drinking the rat poison and thinking the rat will die. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it's the hardest work we do and the most profound spiritual effort we can make, and will bring with it the greatest increase. But again, it's easier said than done, and I have needed a lot of help.
Dave, thank you.
But thank you. That's very sweet. Yeah.
So, we talked a little bit about you throwing the right-wingers under the bus. We have a lot of secular listeners who probably think, that Anne Lamott, she is so smart and sarcastic and sophisticated, but she still clings to that religion stuff as a frame. Why someone like her? What would you say to those people?
Well, I would say that we're very, very complex as a species, and we're beautiful, and we're screwed up, and we're a very violent species, and Cain is still killing Abel, and I have all that inside of me, and I have this incredible tenderness and gentleness towards the world, and the information and truth doesn't come in on bumper stickers. So the religious or spiritual followers I have hate that I'm so political, and the left-wing or liberal progressive people that really like my work and my activism hate that I'm religious. So what are you going to do?
Michelle,
it's really none of my business. Yeah.
Michelle in Yorktown Heights, you're on WNYC with Anne Lamott. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, how are you? Anne, I really wanted to tell you that your book, Operating Instructions, saved my life when I had my first baby. I read it probably 16 years ago, and there's still things that make me laugh out loud about, like, being in the shower with your underwear on and your brother eating, like, many pots of rice because you were trying to make rice water for your son's colic.
I've forgotten all that.
I'm a labor and delivery nurse, and I recommend your book to my patients all the time. So there's that. And then second, I wanted to thank you for writing the Rosie novels. I adore Rosie. I hold a little piece of her with me all the time. And now I have a 14-year-old very, I'm nervous. I'm never starstruck, Anne. I just adore you. And I have my daughter reading your books, too. And we're just huge fans. Thank you for doing what you do.
Well, thank you. I know you didn't ask for advice, and I love your thoughts and kindness, but I would really read the book I wrote with Sam called Some Assembly Required, which is a follow-up to Operating Instructions, because it's really about being the mother of a growing or grown child and how you have to release these children to their own holiness path and their own hero's journey. You really at some point can't run alongside them with juice boxes and chapstick trying to get them to do exactly what you're positive would be the best possible course of action. So Some Assembly Required is really about letting go, you know, and of course we always say whatever we let go of, in my case, has claw marks on it. But I do have tiny, tiny, tiny control issues, and they were at their worst when I had a teenage son. So maybe that book would give you some ideas. For instance, there's one acronym in it called WAIT, W-A-I-T. Why am I talking? Since it just seems to aggravate them. And they're not interested in your opinions and your tiny thoughts on what they're wearing. And so I've been walking around saying WAIT for about 10 years now.
Michelle, thank you for calling. Kimberly in Asheville, North Carolina, you're on WNYC with Anne Lamott. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi. I am just so grateful to you, Ms. Lamott. I've never called into anything before, never spoken to a writer I admired before, but I have to tell you, you just changed my life. I was raised in a liberal Baptist church in New Jersey, moved down south with a very strong faith, and just got completely turned off by the politics that were so intertwined with the churches here and didn't mesh with mine. As much as I tried to make that work, it didn't. Was heavily into Y2K and decided December 31st, 1999, I was going to sit down and read your book as a little treat for myself. And it just completely validated my feelings that I could still have a relationship with my God. And, you know, the churches didn't matter, the politics, you know, that was just irrelevant. And just thank you. And Operating Instructions as well. My 19-year-old was pregnant with a child when that book came out, and that just was such a blessing, too. So you give voice to a lot of people, and I turn everybody that I love in my life onto your books because there's just so much truth there.
Oh, and Anne, you say you're not a self-help author.
I'm not a self-help author. No, I'm definitely not. I tell the truth, though. I'm a truth teller. And the hugest experience spiritually you can have with another person is for them to listen and to say, me too. So when I wrote Operating Instructions, which was 1992, there hadn't been women, mothers coming out yet and saying that it really wasn't lining up with what they'd seen on TV and that they were a little tiny bit more anxious and angry than they thought they'd be and that they were so wasted with exhaustion that they were thinking about leaving the baby outside just for the one night, nicely bundled up with the dog, so that they could get one night's sleep. And when I said that, people cried and they said, me too, because no one would ever admit it before. So I think I tell the truth, and it's like chemotherapy. It is for me when someone tells the truth. But anyway, I don't think that's a that's not a point that I'm going to belabor. If you think I'm a self-help, I mean, I love helping people. But what I want to say to this woman was I always think that my biggest fans are ministers, rabbis, and lesbians. But it turns out that the people that really I think I'm helpful to is people that grew up in really awful fundamentalist or hypocritical religious families and communities where it was just so much of it was a crock, you know, because you heard people spout scripture and trash the wife or be unfaithful or hurt the children. And so my point or my position is that everybody gets to think what they want, but if you find a way of connecting with some higher power, some power greater than yourself, or some unseen reality that feels as real as what you can see. That's all we're talking about here. It's like a lot of my friends, one of my friends, always calls God Howard because she's Jewish and very secular. But she has been so helped by what I would dare to call grace that she says, "Our Father who art in heaven, Howard be thy name." And so she's always talking about, boy, Howard came through. So I just don't think it matters what you call God or if you can get everything to line up nicely with something that some aging white man tells you is true about yourself. It's just about finding yourself. It's finding your way to your own heart and your own heart cave. You know, that's what women want. That's what we want.
Anne Lamott with us on WNYC. Her new book is Small Victories, Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace. Can you talk about the concept of grace? You had that bestseller, Grace Eventually, and the subtitle of this book is Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace. What is grace?
Oh, Brian. You know, it takes whole books for me to say, but in the Christian tradition, they would say that it was unmerited help. I would say that it is a form of spiritual WD-40 where you're very stuck and your thinking is bad. Your thinking is the ping pong game of self-loathing and narcissism. And you are in a very grippy, clenched state of kind of madness. And you get the spritz of the WD-40 and you can breathe again. Or miraculously, you get your sense of humor back. That's when I know grace has arrived. I've always said laughter is carbonated holiness. And when I can laugh again, when someone can make me laugh, when I get a very friendly sense of humor back about myself, I feel like that's what we're talking about. You could say grace is like water wings if you're in water where you're a little frightened that you might go down, or very frequently a second wind when you can't go on. Or we think you can't go on, you're used up and you hate everyone. Mm. And all of a sudden, there's a little bit of wind in your sails. And for me, a lot of it has to do with surrender because I have a disease of good ideas. I'm almost positive that my ideas are the very best possible course of action for almost everyone, including everybody listening to your show today.
Like most guests.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
But I remember once I was going to Africa, and I asked I have a tiny little church of about 30 people, and I asked them for prayers because I'm afraid of, you know, I don't really believe in flying, and I was pretty afraid about, I'm pretty afraid of snakes. And I asked for prayers, and my pastor said, you know, when you're on a plane, it's a little late for beggy prayers, and it's really time for trust and surrender. And when the plates of the earth shift beneath me and I go from clenched and tight and slightly, you know, bitter to feeling this kind of surrender and trust, that to me is the movement of grace in my life.
And you did that so well. What about faith? What does faith even mean to someone who writes about life's toughest emotional hardships? Faith that what?
Well, faith that it's going to be pretty much semi sort of okay if we just keep helping each other get back up. I know I have absolute faith that I stopped drinking 28 years ago. I have absolute faith that if I don't drink or use today, everything is going to be semi sort of okay. I have absolute faith that if I'll just bust myself gently when I'm in my most toxic thinking and pick up the 200-pound phone and call a girlfriend or a guy and tell them the truth, that they will listen and they will say those words, "Me too, yep, I get it, I'm not there today, but I know what it's like, can I get you a cup of tea," that I'm going to experience some measure of mental healing. All my problems are thinking, it's like a ticker tape of anxiety and domination and control and victimization and self-righteousness. And when I listen to someone and they hear me and we start to laugh again, I'm able to let go of that and to have that faith that the things, you know, things don't have to make sense for there to be meaning in our lives. You know, humanity is meaningful, and figure it out is not a good slogan. But usually I need to call someone for them to remind me of this. And then I can breathe again and I go, oh, right. You know, I'll do radical self-care. I'll have some M&Ms. I'll take the dog for a walk. I'll get the new issue of People magazine, all the various spiritual sacraments, the sacrament of plop and of letting go and letting down and, you know, watching Survivor. And I have faith that it will pass.
That was great. Julie in Westchester, you're on WNYC with Ann Lamott. Julie, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, Julie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. And I love your books, and you've made me almost Catholic again. But
aren't you Presbyterian or something? Anne?
I am. I'm a nice Protestant girl, but I do wear a Mary around my necklace. But go ahead, honey. I'm listening.
Thank you. Here's my question. It's kind of a biggie. The reason I'm almost Catholic again is I can see grace in my life everywhere. But what I can't reconcile is all the suffering of babies and disasters and disease and the ghastly things that are happening to people every day. You know, my life is a cakewalk. And how does this work? Because I'm not really better than those people. So what's the story?
I know. It's a question people have been unable to answer for our entire stay here on this funny blue marble. How can this be right? How do we even live in the face of it? But with my last book, Stitches, I began it on the Friday after the shootings at Newtown because I was going to be teaching Sunday school in 2 days. And I tell my little ones and my teenagers that they are loved and chosen and it's a come-as-you-are party and that they're safe. And if they don't feel safe, come find one of us. And we'll sit there in it with them and help walk them through. And so Stitches might be a book. I don't know if you've read it, but it's really about where we find meaning in just catastrophe and the suffering of children, the suffering really of 90% of the world and how we go on. And how, there's one story I'll tell you, and then I'm probably about to get the hook. But when I was starting to write Stitches, I thought, where can you even start after Sandy Hook? And I remembered Barry Lopez, the great novelist, saying that sometimes we need a story more than we need food, and that also when all is said and done, all we really have are compassion and stories. So I thought of this one story my pastor told about this war horse that comes upon a little sparrow lying by the side of the road with its legs sticking straight up, and the war horse, who I always picture as Donald Rumsfeld, makes this huge snorting, neighing warhorse laugh and says, what are you up to? And the sparrow says, well, I heard that the sky is falling and I wanted to help. And the horse just kept laughing and says, you really think you're going to hold back the darkness with those skinny little legs? And the sparrow says, one does what one can. And so I showed up, I fed my children at Sunday school. We did arts and crafts. We gathered granola bars and water. We distributed it to the homeless. You know, Mother Teresa said, none of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. I pick up litter, you know. I'll go around the neighborhood and I'll pick up litter. And one does what one can. And I know what it feels like. And you just got to have faith that if you do a few small gestures of kindness, you flirt with the old people at the health food store. You share your, you know, in India, in America, we're storing up all these bananas and they're all going bad because we can't get enough. And in India, you see people lying in the street and they break off the banana they have and they share it with the person next to them. So the law of the American jungle is share your bananas.
Share your bananas. And since we can't possibly top that, we will give you the hook, as you called it. How's that for no good deed goes unpunished? You tell a great story with a great ending and you get ushered out the door. Anne Lamott, thank you so much. Latest book,
Thank you, Brian.
Small Victories, Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace. Everybody feels better now.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.